coming. I'm very happy that tonight, in honor of this occasion, my band was able to make it here and drive up from Jersey. So they're going to play a set with me before I do the actual reading. So please welcome the unknown, the man who ruined my career, Scott Repberg.
Yes, The Unknown is a hypertext novel. There's links. If you're watching it on the screen, you would see the link as a word with a blue underline. Since we don't have a screen, we're going to ring a call bell anytime there is a link. When you hear the bell, you can shout out the word which immediately preceded the bell or which took place simultaneously with the bell. You could also shout out map and give us the name of a location in the United States. People, and we'll read a list of people for you, and bookstores, and we'll read a list of bookstores that we shamed ourselves in on our tour.
Here's the unknown. Toward the end of the millennium, we had published a book of our best writing, and we traveled the world to promote it. We were generally reckless and lucky, and the whole undertaking proved to be very successful. We had done, we felt, good work, and we deserved to live our dream. Then, after we returned from China, we were offered the opportunity to write a motion picture, and so we moved to Los Angeles. Well, what then happened has been documented elsewhere, but the point is that fame and wealth very nearly destroyed us. Before the end, one of us had died. Another had had a kind of epiphany, and I had become the sworn enemy of a number of people who used to find me quite likable.
Were we spokespeople for a generation we had never met, a generation who found that getting degrees was a way to buy legitimacy and respect as a thinker and an individual for a short time, but then again, there were jobs. Jobs would take one look at you and squint, and the totality of who you were would be refracted into a list, which the job would then hand back to you and say no. And they terrified us, these jobs, and we never spoke to each other about each other. It was always about the jobs. The jobs we couldn't have that didn't want us. But there we were, and we were good writers, as good as anyone, job or not. And we were, in effect, the language and the species. We were writing history, texts that history would sort from the slogans and ads, and somehow we had failed to notice this. We needed jobs to prove that there was nothing wrong with us, but there was something wrong with us. We were alive, and we were together, and we knew what we were doing, but we were waiting for the jobs to separate us and silence us and lead us off one by one to the altar or the gallows. But we made this book. We made this book over many years, which we're waiting for it and which are living in it. These words come from Champaign and Chicago and Normal and Seattle and Alaska and Cedar Rapids and Cincinnati and San Francisco. We wind up Midwest, in the middle for now. This is where the three of us gather, and then to the winds and such.
So let's go over the links. Buy legitimacy, a thinker, a list, there, we, jobs, wrong, waiting, altar, gallows, Champaign, Chicago, Normal, Seattle, Alaska, Cedar Rapids, Cincinnati, San Francisco, wins.
And it's your job to ask for one of those words.
Champagne.
Unusual choice. I don't know how Marla got us a gig at the University of Illinois, but that was some fast, easy, good money. Philip Graham was there, and he was very encouraging. He bought an extra copy of The Unknown to send to Ralph Berry in Tallahassee. It was on account of Philip Graham that Scott and I met, and I told him that then. Back one day in the early 90s when I was working in restaurants and writing like the Dickens, I stopped by Philip Graham's office in the U of I English building and he gave me a copy of Grand Street with the story by Crass Mueller, which had the phrase, "Medieval California's fluorescent basin," something like that. And Philip Graham said, "How would you like to study with this guy?" Beats working, I thought, but I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to taint my dear mentor's upcoming sabbatical. We read at the Center for Advanced Study. Dirk spilled punch on Lawrence Lieberman, but said it was an accident. The Schnierz people gave us a prize that we had to lie to get. Then we went for beer and discourse with Carrie Nelson and Michael Berube, who had some interest in the project. Richard Powers was there, too. He was very talkative. He invited us to lunch the next day at the Courier.
Then.
What?
Then.
Then?
Maybe they meant beer?
Beer, California.
Then?
Meant beer.
He meant beer.
Beer. Geddes wanted to play pool against all three of us. He said that he already had his team, that they were all lounging around up there in his head. Geddes and Dirk lagged with a break. It was mid-afternoon and we were the only people in the place. Geddes won, the cue ball coming to rest the width of a cigarette from the bumper. Geddes pulled a cigarette from a silver cigarette case he withdrew from the inside pocket of his tweed jacket, offering each of us one. Geddes lit his cigarette and leaned over the table and broke with one solid stroke, a crack and a technicolor explosion of balls. The two ball went in. Scott went away and came back carrying four pint glasses of Bass Ale. Geddes picked up his cigarette and used it and set it down and tried to hit the 14 ball into the three ball, knocking the three ball into a side pocket. But his measured stroke, while accurate, was slightly too gentle, and the three ball came to a rest beside the pocket. The bartender lit a cigarette and stared through the neon out at the afternoon street and traffic. Dirk took up the cue, cigarette dangling from lip, and tried to hit the 14 ball into the side pocket by easing it between the pocket and the three ball. He instead knocked the 14 ball into the three ball and knocked the three ball in. Geddes took another long drink and half his beer was gone. You can shout out an insight.
Matt.
William Geddes beat us at pool.
Okay, where would you like to go in the United States?
Weehawken.
Can you give us a state?
New Jersey.
New Jersey. I don't even know if we have Jersey. Didn't we? What was that boardwalk?
I think this is close enough.
We said fuck a lot that trip.
Our first worming into the Big Apple, it treated us rotten. We were still completely unknown, and this was a town that didn't have a lot of time for you if you weren't known. We met with Marla. That was when she officially became our publicist, so that was cool. But all the other buzz about the unknown that time around was mostly self-generated. We did impromptu readings at the Strand, at Gotham Books, at the Union Square Barnes & Noble. Fucking Strand, fucking Gotham, fucking Barnes & Noble at Union Square. New York City, I gotta admit, has the toughest fucking bookstore security forces you ever fucking heard of. We were taken down again and fucking again. Dirk received a fucking black eye at the Strand. Scott injured his fucking ankle at Gotham. William broke a fucking rib at Barnes & Noble. It was not fucking pretty. Aside from the generous and warm reception we received at the 92nd Street Y and the fact that Marla in person turned out to be drop-dead gorgeous and, well, let's face it, attractive to Scott, the trip was pretty much a professional bust.
Publicist.
Should we have Jane? Jane's here.
Really?
Yeah.
Should I ring my own?
It's hard to explain how this is creating closure on my entire experience at Brown. You know.
It was never easy to manage their raw talent. It would have been far easier to manage a raw squid. Talent is always difficult, and they had a lot of that and that. They were erratic. They were a challenge. They were intellectuals. They were dynamic, and they excited me. I wanted to spread that excitement. That is what I do. Most of my clients before the unknown wrote genre fiction, romance, mystery, suspense. I'm a commercial person, and if you say that what I do is shallow, I won't argue too vociferously. I'm about buzz, making a good buzz, and not always for good books, and not always for books that I myself would read. This is the career that I have chosen. I'll never change the world, but I know what makes a great headline. I know how to get reviews. I know how to place an artist anywhere from a shishi cocktail party to a university symposium. I can get you in the Village Voice. I can get you interviewed. I can get you a reading at a multiplicity of bookstores. I know how to bend the right ears. I'm good at what I do. I work the phones. I work the phones. I have a BA from Vassar with a double major in English and advertising. I like Victorian novels, how they take their time to fulfill a long, slow arc. How they create a world from manners. How they turn the position of governess from a menial occupation to one that is heroic. I ride the streams of media, which shift from hour to hour. My Rolodex is voluminous. My friends say that I'm a fun drunk. When I drink, which I do on Saturday nights, I swing dance and I samba. I'm not very good at dancing, but I do it anyway, and I have a blast. I'm single, but I'm not lonely. The last time I had sex, I wasn't making love. He was a financial whiz kid who worked for Citibank. It had been months, and he told me a good joke. He was cynical, but was a decent lover. I wasn't in love with him, but we had a few decent dates. I'm not looking for permanence. I don't think I'll meet Mr. Wright, not in New York. None of that matters to me right now. I have a niece named Alyssa, and I take her to the movies every Tuesday night. I took her to see Titanic 3 times, and I'll admit that I cried the first 2 times. I worked for an agency I won't mention here before I set off on my own. I was tired of all the assignments they gave me, mass market dross. I set off on my own, and I took several of their best clients with me, Dick Thrush, author of the Nick Cabin Clown Detective Series, Selena Warble, author of the M is for Murder, L is for Love Series, and Helena Cartwright, author of the Wide River Long Lost Love Pastoral Romance Series. I was paying...
In that blinding shaft of yellow light, Dirk sings from the Gospel of the Unknown, backed by the Kronos Quartet. Dirk sings, "Someone's always fucking with my mirrors and the crowd goes wild." We think the tensions between Dirk's followers and the Secret Service have dissolved in the flaring harmonic murmurs of Dirk's first Platinum A-side, but then we feel that the tensions are precipitating again. Chelsea Clinton and Uma Thurman are dancing cowboy style, then ballroom style, right up in the front row. I become suspicious of the intentions of one of the Latin kings nearest them. Though Dirk's followers generally, or at the very least often, give me the creeps, right now at this moment I feel a sharp sense of identification with them. I'm torn between my enjoyment of this mass love fest. Spielberg is just backstage right, visibly beaming at my compadre Dirk, and a fear that things have simply gone too far, that something is likely to burst at any moment. Buddy Guy steps in midway through the song, which, in my opinion, just blows the roof off that joint, or would have if it had a roof, which, of course, it doesn't. Who could not love each other and all fellow humankind when Buddy is singing with Dirk of the dangers of inappropriately adjusted mirrors and of Cartesian doubt of all known separate sensory apparatuses? It is 11:51. The holographic clock is 50 yards high, and the harp chronometer's pounding is drowned out only by the wail of the guitar and the floating noise of amplified violins, violas. Dirk's voice almost sounds like that of a singer. Then the song is done.
Dirk reads from the Book of Signs. A battalion of mimes takes the stage as the musicians exit. Is this really how he intends to end the show and to end the millennium? With good intentions, a decent gospel, and a mob of mimes? So be it. They, the mimes, are all dressed in purple, which seems both right and wrong. They are people of all nations, of all ages, of all hair colors and skin tones. Okay, none of this is obviously all of anything. There are only 40-some people up there on the main stage, but nonetheless, we're talking about a worldwide diversity type of crowd. None wears any makeup. Some of them turn out not to be mimes after all, but ballet dancers of the utmost grace. Dirk's followers mouth the words to his most famous gospel, and the mimes work the movements and enact his pastoral preachings, along with the ballet dancers who dance stunningly well, considering that there is no music outside of the telltale heart. It is more beautiful than Swan Lake. He finishes at 11:59. The holographic clock now fills the whole stadium. Steven Spielberg joins Dirk as the mimes prance about, circling them, kicking up their heels and maypole dancing. together, Dirk and Stephen, count down to the end of the millennium.
Let's see. So what is to be done is what we are discussing. Frank doesn't know, and then he stirs his mate as if to draw the matter out. Dirk has had perhaps too much gin, and in his eyes there is only jazz and cigarette smoke and a tear that might form like a drop of the sun underneath this electric night at the bottom of the world. There is art, and there is politics, muses William, but he's already lost us, and Scott is looking at Marla across the room where she sits on the edge of the couch, stroking the cat, and he can only think, if. Dirk has stood up somewhat unsteadily to put another record on, and this time it is Billie Holiday, a bird in a golden cage. William has seen Scott looking at Marla, and he is trying to put together this terrible jigsaw puzzle, this child's game with his numb and yellowed fingertips. For a while, there is the issue of cigarettes, as Frank passes around a pack of Galoises. We are relieved of that terrible uncomfortableness that is all a part of not knowing. Then there is a silence as we are swept towards the center of the record where everything is named. Then there is the crackle of a needle in its last dance into the end of the spiral, and only Dirk. Do records spin the other way in the Northern Hemisphere? We will argue about how to say Coriolis force in French, but the matter, like so many other edges of this puzzle, cannot be suitably resolved, and we can no longer escape the sense that the end of the night is near.
Thank you, Scott. I think there's probably a reception after this reading next door at which I have assured Scott he'll be able to make important connections, so I hope we'll all go there and meet him. These are a bunch of notebooks in which I've taken observations of ordinary things. The purpose of this exercise was to try to train myself to pay attention. So what I'd like to do is read the names of some of these entries, and if you hear one that sounds interesting, call out for it. Letter to a hobo. I already lost it. Sorry, you'll have to move faster than that. Zorba's. Kirby Firestone.
Yeah,
Kirby Firestone. Kirby Firestone, June 27th, 2003. Unbelievably manly men stroll about puffing cigars, bulging beneath light blue button-down shirts or shirtless. My car returns from its test drive. I await the diagnosis. This lovely old brick building with peaked roof of red clay tiles. A few customers watch TV among piles of tires. Vines dangle from the eaves. Friday afternoon. Here in Urbana, a fern oasis peopled with dried stalks. A fern oasis peopled with dried stalks stamped horizontal by wind. I'm hungry enough to put ketchup on food. Our way is a tunnel composed of subtleties of brown and gray speckled with new green. Creekward, some large birds engaged in a fracas. Three shoes and a Budweiser bottle tell no tale. A pair of cowboy boots, red, and one sneaker. As the creek converges on northeast Urbana, a sea of junked cars winks between trees. Old engine parts submerged in a vast mud flat, bearing afloat ranks of shattered, gutted, plateless, wheelless, dented, muddy, red, white, blue, maroon, turquoise, vans, campers, compacts, buses, station wagons, husks, hulls, chassises, cars. We step through radiator grills, tire shreds, metal. An overturned, crushed pickup topper cradles a vast mass of deadwood. The sun has set on this. Les's Lounge.
Read it.
Paneled 1970s time capsule in which Dylan and country music drift through a smoky swamp of cigarette memories. Red leather padded bar, octagonal tables sequestered in dark and empty corners marked by solitary candle globes. Young people savoring the alienation mix like oil and water with placid older alcoholics and swung singles of a passing generation. Red felt pool tables pass as class, while a jukebox indicates otherwise. Low-slung televisions provide visual punctuation. The owner's Harley, parked outside, has vanity plates. Here's one my mom wrote. Documentation meeting. The homeless guy, Bill. Newport Cliff Walk. Getting closer to home here. Observatory. This would be May 2nd, 2003. Observatory. Up an octagonal brick stairwell, winds splay through window shades. A man explains the bands of Jupiter. A computer glows. Floor creaks. Us shadows in this darkness. Reflectors on the lawn. In this night, he explains chromatic aberration. Astronomy guys orient us. Squat red barrel cocked at Jupiter. A primary parabolic mirror and tiny reflective mirror. Lorian peers through it. Europa, Io, Ganymede, Callisto. Dead rabbit.
Yeah.
Flies rise and fall as cars pass. Flat, four paws, blood. One eye looks up unafraid but woeful. Unknown organs akimbo. Matted fur, two teeth protrude. A scent of heavy death. Rear legs going wrong ways, a cubist perspective. Thin ribs visible. County Fair. A perfect monarch. A perfect monarch flits by, caramel black pattern wings. Amber stained glass. Humid woods. The Cincinnatian series of the Upper Ordovician Strata, a time rock unit dating back more than 300 million years, can be seen in the outcropping. A few southerners in silent repose fishing beside an artificial lake. Rows of tobacco beyond barbed wire. Bikers for Jesus. Farmview Road. A corner of Cincinnati's sprawl, hotel land. John Kerry rally. All right. Philly Kerry rally. September 24th, 2004. In the baking asphalt, we stand in line with college students of some leftward bent. Register to vote in Pennsylvania. Dude, go to Iraq, shouts a woman to anyone who seems to be endorsing the opposition. Young, beautiful, shabbily dressed, generally unathletic, pro-choicers, Democrats, potheads, and me and Scott, all of the above. I have a bronchial infection. It might be the last warm day of the year. Multitudes. The line barely moving, stretching endlessly ahead. Red, white, and blue balloons hang above a park. Is there a sense of political solidarity here, or more of a decisive splintering? Idealists and opportunists alike work the crowd, accruing signatures, selling buttons. When Clinton lied, nobody died. Suddenly, a flock of Bush sycophants began chanting, "Four more years." What if something happens in this trampled park? Some conflagration? As I am admiring red, white, and blue balloons that seem somehow oppressively spherical, one of them pops, and I almost stumble. You two from PA. My main motivation to jog is to practice running for my life. Did you ever want to be pretty and right? A city crowds around this campus, a Sheraton looming over these assembled Democrats. Many of us sit, apparently patient and content to be kept waiting. Another balloon pops. Paul Wellstone. Will I be able to see him when he speaks? Will the PA amplify his aura? Bare shoulders and a camcorder. Should have worn my sandals. An unseen person has started speaking, riling the crowd. From our position, the amp is followed a half second later by an echo rebounding from a building. Unintelligible, invisible. The ferocity of the oration is compelling but self-defeating given the acoustics. Scott points out where to look.
Go get me Bin Laden if you don't already have him stashed away as an election stunt.
A repeated refrain is especially rhythmic with the reverberation.
This election is about jobs. Let's get America back on track.
So far, no mention of war. We are working our way up through Democratic elected officials. So far, we're up to Congress. Now we hear it.
Cowboy diplomacy.
The crowd goes wild, and the speaker is astute.
Iraqitize Iraq.
John, not Dick. Now the guy is campaigning. A mention of the NRA provokes booing. A field of erect signs, a sense of being on TV, huge balloons lodged in trees. Basic dignity for every person in America. Pro-choice, cheer, pop. The heat is smothering. Sometimes I catch a glimpse of the stage. 39 days left. Words, not birds. Even a confusing syntax may provoke applause if performed correctly. I am weak and sit. A chord suggests it is Carrie's turn to speak. A field of sneakers. What if an American presidential candidate chose a mode of music other than rock? How inextricable is paranoia from the American mindset? Fear of deprivation can suffice for progressive thought. Fear of death for an anti-war stance. Bruce Springsteen. John Kerry. A distant man rolls up powder blue shirt sleeves, high-fives someone, waves. There he is. The crux of destiny? A compromise? Or a losing candidate of negligible historic consequence? He is still gesticulating at the crowd, and perhaps it is a peace sign he holds up. From this distance, I cannot tell. One in particular I'm looking for. Be worth it, I hope. And here it is. This is shortly after I arrived in Providence, and I was at the Ocean Cafe, September 9th, 2003. He shakes, has coffee and cigarettes at the Ocean. Old, thin, trembling, he is being gently interrogated by a gentleman. He claims to be a multimillionaire working 15 hours a week. He is a middleman in fertilizer transactions. $3 million a year for 3 years for 4 hours a week. Now at age 56, I can tell you I'll never retire again. All you need is the money to run the ad in Singapore or Hong Kong's newspaper. He claims to have gone to Brain College on the east side in accounting. The couple who is interrogating him is peaceful, bemused. But now the man I presumed is sane is explaining that Pakistan is about to attack Israel. He's talking about, oh boy. The crazy guy says he'd like to see a couple of nuclear bombs exploded, especially on North Korea. He thinks the environment could handle it. Now he's talking about an ad he ran in the Providence Journal, which made him $240,000 as a middleman. So he thinks we should drop a nuclear bomb on the Arabs. Amen, the sane man says. I'm all for that. Saudi Arabia, his wife chimes in. Now they are discussing energy sources. The crazy man is endorsing nuclear power. The sane man thinks the future of energy lies with fuel cells. If we go with fuel cells, he explains, the Arabs will go back to eating camel dung. We will no longer have an international cartel controlling everything. The crazy guy is named Walter. The sane man is named Sai. Sai is going on in detail about a difficult-to-follow economic theory. The rumble and clatter of traffic obscures the details. I have to admit, this is way more interesting than my obsessions. Money, love, school, literature, whatever. Walter went to a Catholic school and was never molested by a priest. Maybe you aren't attractive enough. The girls don't make me feel that way. I have two children. After working as a professional golfer, I went to med school and someone convinced me to sell my sperm. Now I have 22,000 children. I'm 62 and my son is 6'5". He's played hockey since he was 5. Now he wants to be a rock star. I could buy his albums and send him to the top of the charts. Now they are talking real estate. There's money in skyscrapers. Now they're discussing owning the Washington Redskins. Unlike you, Walter, I'm broke. I just told you how to make $9 million. Sell urea fertilizer to China. Maybe we can go into business together. I don't know how to use a computer. I paid someone minimum wage to use a computer for me. Walter's voice is very slow, halting, deliberate, low-pitched, plodding, unaffected. Sai's voice is sharp and filled with mirth. Sai's wife is mostly silent. My mother died 3 years ago and left me $10 million. Nice talking to you, Walter. You here every day? Every day at 9:30, I meet my girlfriend here. She's an undergraduate at Brown. Does your wife know? I'm divorced. Sai and wife make their exit. Walter disappears down Waterman. His suit jacket hangs with dignity from his tall and bony frame. The sun goes behind a cloud. Whatever I thought I was thinking about, tension, problems, whatever, is long gone. My solipsism broken wide open, I admire life and its curiosities. So now I'm going to read a piece of writing. Carol Maso had given us the assignment to come up with two images and combine them somehow. So I went home that night, got out my my notebook, and I tried to have an image. And it wasn't happening, and I needed two images. So I went and bought a Boston Globe and a Providence Journal, and that is how I managed to complete the assignment. So this is my news poem for Friday, February 27th, 2004, and it is called Risky School Shooting Cut Short by Suit Malfunction.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces invaded a small and helpless neighbor. A member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations was crushed, its people brutalized. Our operations are designed to best protect our vast military arsenal. Arrogantly, we and our allies systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation, subjected the people to unspeakable atrocities, and among those maimed and murdered, innocent children. Our objectives are clear. To our own economy, with hope and contempt.
Specks of dust dribbled away. They unzipped the canvas bags and stepped out, drifting over the tables. Some of the kids looked up at them. One was amazed. Another laughed. One threw a carton of milk. Rock discharged his firearm. A wave of consternation swept the room. The recoil from the shotgun made him spin end over end until he came to rest entangled in the light fixture. Skinny girl down, pretty boy pop. The whistle of air blowing out of the depressurizing cafeteria. Rock watched trickles of condensation inside the helmet wriggling away from the oxygen blowers lit by the headlamp. He raised the weapon to the visor and the sights wavered in the liquid sheeting his helmet glass. Jockhead fell forward on the floor, blood pouring from the back of his head. It was awesome. So red. Hawking carefully maneuvered around the tether to check Rock's suit. Roller coasters of screams poured under them. It was comical the way those idiots ran, wide-eyed, elbows akimbo, hands to faces. Mr. Smith looked directly into their eyes for the first time in years as he pushed the door to his classroom shut. The thump as a heavy table was pushed onto its side to barricade a door. Two sharp retorts cast flashes through the rivulet streaking the helmet. The shape of Hawking moved down the hallway, lightning in a rainstorm. Crackle. That scream was unbelievable, a profound wail twisting from below. Had to be a teacher. An expletive and a bang. Red flex. Rock hung somewhere over the long folding tables. Who could still be lurking in the cafeteria? Or who might be creeping up he could not see? Who might be behind him? He considered cocking the firearm, taking a tough pose, but machismo failed him. In some tiny corner of his head, the thought they could get out. Too young for the death penalty. Fuck it, they were already famous. After Mission Control releases the footage, drop the gun, he could just drop the gun. Nobody was going to shoot an unarmed 8-year-old in a spacesuit. A broken spacesuit. They might smack him around, but he was ready for that, might enjoy it. Like to see someone try it. Rock was on the beach. The sun was high and warm. He lay out on the sand and watched people surf. He saw Hawking out there riding in on a slow curl. Something moved across the sun. A gloved hand. Hawking was upside down, waving. Crackled Hawking, almost inaudible beyond the polyglossia. The flame from the jet winked. He felt a hard tap on the helmet and through the surf could discern a perfect circle, the mouth of a barrel. News poem, January 6th, 2001. Elegant by comparison. Even Nixon was a smoother criminal. Justice Scalia has countered with the precedent that the American people have never had right of suffrage in an American election. It being necessary for any free and democratic society to bail out savings and loans, the tax burden ought now to be shifted to the Electoral College, the Supreme Court, and a Simi Valley concert hall filled with Frank Sinatra fans, when, in an unprecedented television appearance of a candidate during an election, Rutherford B. Hayes explains that, reliable exit polls notwithstanding, he is going to win the state of Florida. I find myself wanting to change the channel to Nader's speech, but my landlord, at the other end of the bar, refuses to concede the remote control. The ghost of Trotsky keeps trying to tell me that this evidence of a division among the bourgeoisie clearly signals that conditions are ideal for a proletariat revolution, but 20,000 jobless former GM employees, unable to decipher question 2 out of 100 on the state of California's application for food stamps, think it's just politics as usual. To those who think in terms of gush and bore, I plead, but I wanted the October surprise, not Chevy Chase's Gerald Ford. Couldn't we at least have a coup with a little class? Jimmy Carter's speech on campaign finance reform is drowned out by a formation of $2 million Tomahawk cruise missiles en route to Baghdad, seeking an opportunity to defend themselves against anthrax, a lilting centaur, autonomy, journalism, a thrown bottle, a speck of dust, or a blowjob someone had the audacity to try to avoid talking about on TV, still sticky from all the duct tape used to repair the Asian financial crisis. He glances at the teleprompter, trying to remember whether he's the liar or the dumb guy. If you are a non-citizen applying for Medi-Cal and you are not A, LPR, B, an amnesty alien with a valid and current I-688, or C, PRUCOL, an alien permanently residing in the U.S. under the color of law, please do not fill in the shaded box for birthplace. The contradictions between slavery and wage labor were of necessity replaced by the contradictions between labor and capital, the Republican Revolution. From the Wormley House Hotel to the Bohemian Grove, where the justice's son's boss is the lawyer for the plaintiff, the justice's wife the plaintiff's employee, the Secretary of State the campaign chairman, and the father is the brother is the son. Excuse me, but your oil platform is standing on my foot. When Newt Gingrich gets his own radio show, we will come to understand the necessity to read between the lines of riot troops. So let's tune the radio to static and chant together. The first step is admitting you have a problem. The second step is refusing to cede the election to a higher power. You liberals are just nuts about Chomsky, the waitress says, popping her gum, but you don't look up. This is the last thing. Can someone please give me a number between 1 and 80?
53.
As far as I'm concerned, I get my choice of 53 or 12. Oh, but I read 12 at the last reading.
53.
Chapter question. What is the unique evolutionary advantage of the telephone? 4 billion years ago, conditions on Earth were unsuitable for inventions. The atmosphere consisted of hydrogen, methane, ammonia, and water vapor. There were no grounded outlets, and the sky was racked with power surges. From these corrosive beginnings, crude unicellular phones were created spontaneously. Within 1 million years, the phone had adapted to life on shore, and telephone poles towered above the Earth. Various adaptations have made the phone better able to compete with other inventions, the Strauger electromechanical selector, the answering machine, the beeper. Scientists believe these adaptations came about in response to hostile conditions through random mutation. However, the remains of a fossilized phone unearthed in Scotland by Alexander Graham Bell resembles a footprint found by Elijah Gray near Chicago, dated to about the same era. Are telephones indigenous to North America? Or did they migrate across a giant land bridge stretching across the Atlantic from eastern Siberia to Tierra del Fuego?
Everybody's got a little light under the sun, under the sun, under the sun.
You expected y'all to break your brother wreck. She next been hard while the wreck and elected prom queen on the strength of my last record. Hectic and egg and do it backstage after y'all exit. About 3 minutes, start counting back seconds. I got sex is begging to make me breakfast. Winnipeg to Texas, East to egg to eggs, Miss ass and exes. Make them other senses, girls again anorexis. Ain't nobody can do what I do. Can't have what I have, untouchable, don't be mad. If all the girls need love too, then I guess I'm bad. Feel like maxi pad, magic and light. It's just some crazy spark I always had. Y'all gonna feel like Chris Columbus when you discover me under the covers, undercover in reverie. Readily, I'd say I was bigger than Jesus. Save the formal apology for my anthology and Regis.
Stand off, hands off, the princess recessing y'all. Fresh air in the game, hands off. She's untouchable, untouchable. What? Untouchable. What? Untouchable. What? Untouchable.
I'm the finest of the best, and if that don't make sense, who cares? Look at how I dress, and if that don't make sense, I'm gonna talk about you in past tense. And if that don't make sense, fuck you, I'ma go smoke sand.